I'd like now to welcome back to the program Susan Tarman. She is coordinator for the Santa Fe Group, Group 122 of Amnesty International. And this week, this Friday, as they do every year, from 8 to noon here at the Santa Fe Baking Company, there is an Amnesty International Write-A-Thon, which we'll be telling you about in a moment. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So, first of all, what's Amnesty International all about?
Amnesty International is about having a voice for people without a voice. It started in 1961. A gentleman in London wrote a letter on behalf of some Portuguese students that were jailed for speaking out against human rights abuses in Portugal, and he wrote a letter to the Independent in London, and the outcry was so big that the students were released, and that is the basis. Over the last 50 years, they have now released over 300,000 prisoners of conscience around the world.
Is that right?
Yes.
That's huge.
I know. And it's from writing a letter and putting a stamp on it.
And it's, I mean, the power of public opinion is incredible.
Yes. And I wish we took that, especially in these days, more to heart.
Now, so you do these write-a-thons, and basically a bunch of people get together, have coffee, eat the delicious pastries, sit around
right.
and talk. And Amnesty International makes it very easy because you provide the kind of format, the papers and pencils and dresses and all of that.
That's right. All you have to do is show up with your favorite pen. We have everything here. This year is going to be a little bit different and even easier because they're starting to go, Amnesty is starting to go cyber more than ever in the past. Out of the 10 prisoners of conscience that we are writing on behalf of, only four have they provided addresses for. The rest, the other six, are you send an email. So it's a little different this year. Bring your computer. They have free Wi-Fi here at the baking company, and you can write four letters by hand, and the six letters you send an email. So we've shortened it by about an hour this year because of that.
Very interesting. Now, is email as powerful as a letter?
The polls say no, but again, I think that's changing, especially because the write-a-thon is concentrated in a two-week period. You're going to shut down people's inboxes or computers or whatever you call that in cyberspace, because I went online to do my online letters 5 days ago, and it said that the number of letters received, emails sent out, was 17,000. 2 days later, I went back on that site. The number of action taken worldwide was 37,000. So in 2 days, 30,000.
Some dude's inbox has 37,000 emails in it.
That's right. That's right. So the polls from the past have always said that handwritten letters mean more, but I think that's slowly changing.
So tell us about some of the people on whose behalf Amnesty International is writing this year.
Well, we're down from 15 of last year, we're down to 10. The countries, I'm going to start with the countries because the names are so hard for me to pronounce. Belarus, the people of Tarawanga, Libya, Maria Isabel Franco from Guatemala, which is a sad case because she's deceased, and Hussein Salam Mohammed Al-Mafardi, he's USA, he's in Guantanamo. Those are the four that will be handwriting letters
okay.
on behalf of. The other countries involved is China, Dominican Republic, Egypt, Iran, Nigeria, Romania, Sudan, and Taiwan. And they're almost all prisoners of conscience based on human rights. They are human rights advocates.
Now, tell us some of the stories of, I mean, we can't maybe do all of them, but a few of these people. What have they done? Why were they jailed?
Well, human rights-wise, the one that stands out is Mr. Bailan. Vygotsky from Belarus. He is connected with a human rights organization that's getting help to the people of Belarus, and they've made it so difficult for him that he had to try to set up bank accounts in surrounding countries to try to get money into Belarus to help these people.
They accused him of having a foreign bank account.
That's right.
Because they wouldn't let him set up his own bank account.
And the whole trial was horrific on human rights standards. It was a kangaroo court, and he's thrown in jail like so many of these people always are on trumped-up charges, things that aren't true, and of course, again, someone without a voice. He was chairman of the organization of Center Visenya. That is the name of his organization. Maria Isabel Franco is an interesting case, a very, very sad case. But I bring her up because it's the first time in my 5 years of running this organization here in Santa Fe and holding the write-a-thon that we've written on behalf of someone who's deceased. And she was 15 years old when she was raped to death in Guatemala.
Raped and murdered in Guatemala.
Yes.
I mean, she presumably wasn't a human... Was she a human rights worker?
She was just a woman.
Ordinary person.
And the other reason I bring this up, her mother is the one that has not dropped the fight against getting some resolution on this case. And the reason I bring it up is because that's where our group is sort of going this year, violence against women.
So tell us more about what the local Amnesty International here in Santa Fe is doing.
Well, this year, 2012, in a couple of our meetings, we talked about the need to start making our pleas more local, feeling like perhaps they'll get more attention if we are more local. We've always brought human rights abuses to the attention of our local senators and congressman, but we feel we wanted to do it even more so. And VAWA, the Violence Against Women's Act, was brought up again this year to be re-signed, and there was trouble keeping it well-funded. And so instead of just dealing with it on a national way, we brought it up. We said, let's bring it up into the state of New Mexico. Let's connect with groups in New Mexico that are fighting against violence against women.
And so this was the Violence Against Women Act is a national piece of legislation?
Yes, it is. It's a funding, it's a legislation that funds groups that can go into the community and make a difference, trains police officers on violence against women, creates offices in the health care providing sector to deal with violence against women. So they, like a lot of the legislation that trickles down to the people in the country, is getting tweaked and squeezed like so many are. And so instead of trying to tackle the legislation in Washington, we said, let's bring it to New Mexico. So we've connected with some local groups.
And so how are you working with them?
Well, we're going to start by having some of the members of these groups come to our meetings and not only talk to us about the work they do, which involves legislation here in New Mexico, but also in very creative ways. Poets, singer-songwriters, and artists are coming to our meetings and reciting their poetry and singing their songs and describing their artworks that get out into the community that have a message.
How bad is that? I mean, we had folks from the Rape Crisis Center in Esperanza on the other day on this program, but from your perspective, what do you see when you look at violence against women here in New Mexico and in Santa Fe in particular?
Well, I'm learning a lot from the groups that I've connected with. I'm learning, and a lot of the people I've connected with so far are Native Americans, and I don't think I, as a white person, understand how serious the land is to Native Americans in terms of their community. So one woman I talked to, Beata Tozzi Pena from Tewa Women United, She, along with other women I talked with, but she particularly said that when the land, when there's violence against the land, that is what leaks into the community, leaks into the family, leaks into the women and children's lives. It starts with violence against the land. And of course, Santa Clara Pueblo has been dealing with that since the 40s. But I think...
In what ways?
With the lab.
Oh, okay.
With the lab. And, you know, borrowing their land for what was going on in the 40s here, and then not giving it back after World War II.
Right.
And then I think the real violence happened last year in the fire. And they're still reeling from that.
Yeah.
And I don't think we have a sense of... And I'm getting that sense hooking up with these people from the Pueblos that it has had a devastating effect on the community.
It's so, these cultural differences, I think, are so interesting and important because we sort of Euro-Americans can live in big cities and walk on cement all day and
yes.
eat food from far away and not be violent toward each other and, you know, live a perfectly reasonable life and enjoy it and all of that. And so... making that connection is something that we might not intuitively do.
You know, Maria Naranjo told me a very interesting story. She heads up HOPE, Honor Our Pueblo Existence, which is out of Santa Clara. And she goes to these meetings with these Euro-Americans from Bechtel and the University of California that all are part of the lab. And she shows up with the items for her altar that she puts in the middle of the conference table. And these people in suits look at her and say, they don't just look at her with a look, they say to her, what are you doing? She said, we would never have a meeting like this without bringing our sacred objects as a part of the meeting. And it has an impact. And by the local Amnesty group connecting with these groups, we want to get the networking going so more of us understand and are together. I think we want to help people, but we don't. We want to help ourselves. We're all connected. And we Euro-Americans, I believe, have lost the connection. You know, we don't get a loss of connection until our car doesn't start, or there's not gas for the car, or we wake up and the coffee isn't there. And I'd like to reach out to our community and get the connection back.
You say we've lost the connection, but we talk about it all the time. We do groups like Amnesty International. We're activists. We're out there in the community.
But I feel that when we write those letters and we sign those petitions, we think we are helping someone else. We aren't thinking, boy, I've got to help this person because it's hurting my life. It's hurting my existence. And that's where I think the disconnect is. I think when the information, really more than just writing the letter, but getting the information behind the information in the letter, starts the connection going.
There is a film that I would like to recommend. I think I've talked about it a little bit on this program. The film is called Little Dancer. It's a Russian language movie, and it's about a young woman, really a girl, teenage girl, who wants to be a ballet dancer. She's from a village, and the whole thing takes place against a kind of background of human trafficking. Mm-hmm. And the power of that film, I think, is greater than anything I've ever experienced in terms of reading an article or seeing a movie or any other medium of storytelling in which this whole reality is exposed. And I just would like to recommend it to our listeners because if you ever think this has nothing to do with you, the emotion that you feel when you watch this drama unfold,
yes,
it is you, it is me, it is every single one of us, it is men, it is women, it is the land itself.
Thank you. That is exactly what I've been trying to impart, and we try to impart in our group, is we're in this together. There's a beautiful quote from an Aboriginal activist, Lila Watson, who says, "If you have come here to help us, you are wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with ours, then let us work together."
Right.
And that is the quote we start every meeting with, because we are in this together. And the sooner we realize that, I think the more successful we'll be at eradicating some of these human rights abuses.
And I think making that connection between human rights abuses and environmental destruction,
yes,
you need look no further than the Congo to see exactly how those things go together. The mining for the stuff that we have in our cell phones is connected to the destruction of villages and the rape of women and all of that.
That's right.
We're talking to Susan Tarman from Amnesty International, the Santa Fe group. So if people want to get involved in the local group, what do you do? What are your meetings like? What are your activities?
Well, 2012 has been a big change for our local group. We moved our meeting place over to Somos Un Pueblo Unido on Espenicita Street. We have a beautiful, they have a wonderful facility over there, and it's perfect for our meetings. We meet the last Monday of every month from 5:30 to 7. It's a very short hour and a half meeting. We used to sit down and write letters and talk human rights. Now, this 2013, we're going to make it a little more interesting, having a poet, a singer-songwriter, or an artist at most of the meetings. But they are singing and reciting poetry about the very things we've just been talking about. Our December meeting has been moved up to January 7th because of the Christmas and actually New Year's holiday. So on January 7th, we're going to be having Olivia Romo. She is from Rancho Statehouse, New Mexico. She calls it Del Norte, but she is going to school at UNM. She's going to be reciting her poetry, and she's been working with Chicana groups as well as undocumented immigrant work in her college experience. As I said, she's going to be reciting her poetry and taking Q&A. We're going to have Beata Tosi Pena from Tewa Women United reciting her poetry probably in April. Along with her from Tewa Women United, we're going to have also a musician and an artist. So we have some real interesting people coming up.
So it sounds like it's somewhere halfway between a meeting and a public event.
Well, that's what we're hoping. We'll bring in a few more warm bodies.
So do you have to go to those meetings? Do you have to, like, officially join, or can people just show up?
Can just show up. We have an announcement in the calendar in the Santa Fe, New Mexican, the day of or the few days before the meeting. So it's a gentle reminder there that we're meeting. And I did want to say one more thing about January 7th. We will be mentioning a couple of the legislative points coming up for this year. Tina Cordova with Tula Rosa Basin Downwinders Consortium, trying to get some funding from putting in an amendment for people who were affected by the Trinity site explosions, GMO labeling out of Highlands social work class, Kathy and Paula Garcia from the New Mexico Acequia Association.
Lots of good stuff, and the legislative session is coming right up, and it's going to be a 60-day session this year.
Yes.
So a lot of new legislation, lots of arguments of many kinds we'll be witnessing.
And you'll be covering.
We'll be covering, yes. Susan Tarman is with the Santa Fe local branch of Amnesty International. It's called Group 122, and once again, the write-a-thon is this Friday from 8 to noon here at the Santa Fe Baking Company.
Just come with your favorite pen.
Okay, Susan, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Brent Cleaver. He's director of film programming with the Santa Fe Film Festival, and Festival Eve is tonight. Welcome, Brent, to the Radio Cafe.
Great to be here, Mary Charlotte, as usual. Long time. How have you been?
Oh, wonderful. And I'm so excited about the film festival. I've been watching movies like a maniac and trying to get filmmakers on the air, and some of them are available and some of them aren't. But let's talk about some of the films. First of all, how do you put together a festival like this? You as the basically the guy where the buck stops in terms of what films actually get into the festival.
Yes, in the terms of the curated films, I want to separate that from the Without a Box films, which include most of the short films, which you've probably discussed with Diane. Those are entry films, and those go through a panel and go through a process of selection. Now, the films, and there are a few features in that category as well. The films I pick are the curated films, of which there are about 37 of them. And we can talk about a few of them. I don't want to go down the list of every one of them. But, right. You know, there's some of the higher profile ones, but yet some of the delicious little obscure items as well. You know, I've been doing this for so long, as you know, that things stick out to me. Filmmakers stick out with me. For instance, the chance to get Raul Ruiz's last film, a film he was made while he was dying, the Chilean filmmaker, very prolific filmmaker, it's a film called The Night Across the Street, was a must for the festival because this ends, you know, several decades of one of the most inventive, creative filmmakers in the history of the medium.
Tell us about the, I haven't been able to get in touch with Andres Wood, who made this movie about Violeta Parra, which is so, I mean, it's a narrative movie, it's a feature film, it's kind of a biopic, but it doesn't even really try to be a realistic movie. It's more like, I mean, I think of it as responding to an artist with another work of art, namely a film, but the actress looks and acts so much like the great Chilean artist and singer and songwriter Violeta Parra that it's really uncanny. How did you come across that film?
Well, it actually won a major award at Sundance, and it just kind of lost its way, and I was searching around for it, and in the midst of all this searching and finding the sales rep in Chile, a company here in the United States, whom I deal with quite a bit at the screen, by the name of Kino Lorber, just picked it up like that. You know, it was just like cosmic forces came together. And I asked for a copy. I had first seen it on this line called Festival Scope, which is this streaming service that's available to film programmers. It comes out of Britain, and you pay so much a year, and you get to watch put your codes in, and you get to watch a film one time. And it's very good for programmers, and you have to prove you're a programmer or a curator for an art house or whatever. So I first saw it on that as a streamer, and then right after I saw that, this company picked it up. And of course, I was looking for Latin American items anyway because of our locale and our closeness to those specific cultures. And also reading the synopsis, I mean, it just seemed perfect. But unlike you, when I saw the film, and you were going, oh, here we go, I'm expecting another biopic, blah, 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 blah. And this is anything but. It goes out of its way to be very innovative. It goes out of its way to go against the traditions of biopics. I mean, this is no whitewashing. The woman herself is depicted in a very contradictory way. And like you say, at times it feels like a documentary. The structure of the film goes back and forth, and it's not doesn't uphold to a normal narrative tradition. It's not just this kind of simple, and then they did this, and then they did this, and then they did this. And I was really taken back by the filmmaking qualities because it was anything but your usual biopic.
Which I loved about it. I mean, as you say, it moves around in time. Now, Violeta Parra, by the way, the film is called Violeta Goes to Heaven, is from an incredibly prolific artistic family. I mean, I think all of her brothers and sisters ended up being major artists or creative people of one kind or another. Doesn't go into that at all. It's just about her character, and I think it's one of the most touching and realistic depictions of, I don't even want to call it unrequited love, but it's a kind of complicated love story that changes over time. Beautifully done.
it's very tempestuous. I mean, it's, and you know, she goes off on that, you know, she's not a good mother. Let's not kid ourselves.
Yeah.
I mean, here's this woman that's going on speaking for other people's rights and is a terrible mother herself.
Right, exactly.
You know, she comes back to find one of her children dead of pneumonia, you know. And I think you mentioned something. While the whole family was a family of artists, that's 10 movies there. And that's too many times filmmakers think they have to tell the whole story. And they end up not telling anything, or they end up, you know, spreading themselves too thin and not focusing on what makes this character interesting. And so they've chosen to focus on her, and then of course the whole thing of the museum, that's a tent, and I mean, it's just fascinating.
We're talking to Brent Cleaver about the Santa Fe Film Festival. Then there are some other lovely movies. Well, why don't you, I mean, there's a nice one about Jake Shimabukuro, who is a, this sounds like an oxymoron, but he's a ukulele virtuoso, and that's a beautiful documentary. What are some of your other favorites?
Well, Chun Li and the Poet. It's totally come unknown to this country. It just won the European Parliament Award, which was this major award that the EU Parliament gives. And when a film wins this award, they translate it into 40 different languages and also make a print for each country so that they're able to see this film. It's actually an Italian film that deals with a Chinese barkeep, a woman, who strikes up this odd relationship with this old Slavic gentleman who had come over during the Yugoslavic days, and both sides of their particular ethnic groups make fun of them. I mean, and it's a very human film. You know, she's much younger than he is. I mean, it's a lovely, lovely story. And you'll be hearing more about that. We also, another one I like on the photographer Gregory Crudson, called Brief Encounters. And this is a guy that sets up, you know, these elaborate stagings to photograph. He's more like a movie maker or set director, and then photographs instead of making moving pictures, photographs these speeches. And the director, Ben Shapiro, will be here for question and answer during that. Another, we have the first film from Kenya that has ever been submitted to the Academy Award Foreign Language Picture category. And it's kind of a genre picture and interesting in a young boy that comes from the slums who wants to make it. So it's that kind of hoppity goes to town allegory. But it's very well done, and when you know, in the way it's shot and everything, and comes to town to try to make his fame and fortune in show business, and some lovely performances. There's also Hitler's Children, which is about the people that were related to Hitler's inner circle, the, you know, that had to go through the years afterwards knowing that they were a Goering or a Himmler, or that they were related to these people. If you remember, Stanley Kubrick's wife was related to one of the most famous Nazi filmmakers. I don't know if you saw that. So there's always been this group of people, obviously, that, you know, the old phrase, you can't blame me who I'm related to. So this deals with people that were related to Hitler's inner circle. And Bettina Sellers, who will be there in person, was the great niece of Hermann Goering. And she's in the film and will be there in person.
Very interesting. It's interesting to contemplate, because it's probably the genocide whose perpetrators are most well known by name. Like, nobody can name who was the head of the Armenian or the Rwandan or whatever genocide. Nobody knows those names. And so their children and great-grandchildren can walk around anonymous, which perhaps they should be able to do since they really didn't have anything to do with it. But not this one.
Well, she came, you know, in exile, taser used her husband's name, and she even went so far as to fix herself so that she could never bear children. So it's a very interesting story. She wanted to break the line right with her. There's a lovely animated film called Les Tableaux from France, or the painting, which is about this painting that's in the act of becoming and trying to find its right colors. And it's actually an actual painting from like the 1930s, we think. And it's always, is it finding the colors that are not? It's always taking shape and form and then becoming disembodied only to come together again. Children and adults both. It's a marvelous, marvelous film. We have Werner Herzog's, I mean, he makes so many films, I don't know if this is his latest, but this is certainly one of his latest, called Happy People, A Year in the Taiga, and it's very different than some of his. What he's done is he's taken a six-hour television series of shot by a Russian filmmaker following this Siberian through, you know, a year of his life, okay, in the taiga. And what Herzog has done is taken the footage and pared it down to 90 minutes and added his own narration. And in the typical kind of acerbic and informative Herzogian way that can only be Herzog, but it's a stunning film. It's a stunning film. And that's going to play over at the New Mexico Museum of History. I might add, since we're on that, that we have added, you know, one venue this year in that on Saturday we will also be showing at the New Mexico Museum of History. So there'll be a full day of programming over there.
And there's going to be things like panel discussions. So there's a panel discussion on the 9th of December, I guess that's Sunday, from 10:30 to 2 at the Hotel Santa Fe, which is a panel discussion on the depiction of gay men on screen at this time in history.
Yes. And that'll be right before the showing of Deception, the film that was left unfinished by its maker when he died of AIDS and was finished by a group of his friends. And so that's actually already a sold-out film. So we also have, I don't have the times on this in front of me, but we also have a panel on the future of film and how in this digital age and in the age of DCP, and the end of the motion picture film, what is the future of film? Because right now, as a theater owner, as you know, we're going through a huge transition. And even for this festival, I'm going through a huge transition because there are certain things, because we have not made that upgrade yet to DCP, that there are certain things I couldn't get because of it. So I still had to look at things strictly in 35 or what was available in 35 millimeter. And also, where we couldn't get 35 or DCP, go with Blu-ray.
So that panel discussion on the future of film history is at the Hotel Santa Fe also, and that's on Friday from 3 to 4:30. And there's all sorts of things that are going on in terms of discussions that people can get involved in.
Oh, right. And everybody needs to go to the website. I mean, I'm just giving you a little bits and pieces of things. There's several filmmakers coming. The director of Vacation Land, which was this wonderful indie shot in Maine, and I think kind of the depiction of it is everybody's nightmare. There was the gist of the story is that there's this family reunion, and at the last minute the reunion is canceled, except whoever put it together forgets to tell five or six of the people that were supposed to come, so they show up anyway. And it's a very sweet picture. It's a very sweet picture. And they all make these kind of new relationships, and some of them are of different age groups, and that stars Karen Black. And we tried to get Karen here, and unfortunately she's unable to come.
Too bad.
But, yeah.
And I think it's important to see narrative films that are not Hollywood, that are made in America, because often they have a kind of emotional quality and emotional sensitivity and truth-telling that you don't really see in Hollywood films.
No, and I agree. And you nailed it right on the head with Vacation Land. I truly think that. And Any Day Now. Any Day Now, which closes the festival, and the director, Travis Fine, will be here. And many people are pushing Alan Cumming for acting awards, even though this is a very low-budget film, and has won some major awards at Tribeca and some places, but it's not a Hollywood film. It is your very low-budget film. These two are Vacationland and this film are very much examples of that type of filmmaking. And also we tried to get Alan Cumming, who had in the past been a guest here, but he's caught shooting The Good Wife in New York. So
okay.
He was an agent. But Travis, the director, will be here. So.
Well, Brent Cleaver is the director of film programming with the Santa Fe Film Festival, and the whole thing opens tonight, Festival Eve, with the movie Now Forager that we will be talking about in a moment, and then really gets underway Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. People can go to santafefilmfestival.com for more information. Brent, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Right. Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte. And I might say we do open, you know, on Thursday with Hyde Park on the Hudson, but it's sold out.
Yeah, right. That's why.
I got to push it. We do have a sellout. So
yeah.
Actually, tickets are selling very, very nicely. So it's always a pleasure to be on your show and the interest you take in us.
Well, good. And people should definitely go get their tickets in advance. If there's even any chance you think it's going to sell out, better to have your tickets in advance. Brent, thanks again.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And I'd like now to welcome Jason Cortland. He is co-director, writer, and lead actor in the film Now Forager, which screens today at 5 o'clock at the New Mexico History Museum. It's part of the Festival Eve event of the Santa Fe Film Festival, and it is followed by a three-course tasting menu at the Coyote Cafe and Q&A with Jason. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having me.
So this is a narrative film. It's a story about a married couple who forage for mushrooms and they cook professionally, and their relationship is kind of starting to fall apart. But it's as much about food as it is about the love story, and particularly mushrooms. Tell us the inspiration for the food part of the story.
Well, my co-director and I, Julia Halperin, started working on the story back in 2005, and it was really about the idea of why we didn't think that so many food movies got the cooking part right. And, you know, with the slow food movement being what it is around the world, you know, people are really more and more interested in not just, you know, cooking techniques, but also ingredients and gardening and canning. And we thought, you know, gosh, there's really an audience for a film that really gets the cooking part right.
It's interesting because the film really deals with the, what I guess you'd call, unglamorous side of working in the food industry and the challenges of making a living. And I think it's the first film I've ever seen or that I'm aware of that deals with both the amazing and beautiful qualities of good food and with basically the working class life of food preparation.
I think that that's definitely something that we're interested in. You know, there are a lot of great filmmakers who are working with, you know, realistic topics and realistic settings and characters today. You know, directors like Kelly Reichert and Ramin Barani are just two off the top of my head whose work we really like in the U.S. You know, I think that there's room out there for films that aren't just, you know, aren't just about entertainment, that are about kind of making a document about where we are in our economy and our culture. And, you know, both Julia and I have worked in restaurants in the past. You know, we both have day jobs while we make films. So working people and are the same people as we are as far as we're concerned.
Now, the character that you play, Lucian Echevarria, he's not, if I may say so, a particularly sympathetic person. He's kind of the anti-salesman. You know, he goes into a restaurant trying to sell his mushrooms and he acts totally superior to the people he's trying to sell to. And at the same time, there's something really beautiful about him to me, the depth of the knowledge that he has and the commitment that he has that both of them have. Are they based on real people?
Sure. You know, I think that there are a number of influences for that character, both, you know, from a writing point of view and from a performer point of view. It's definitely a character. It's more based on people that I know than on, you know, my own personal experience and personality, thankfully, or else I don't know everybody would tolerate me all the time if it were a little bit too much based on myself. But, you know, a character like that, you know, the film is really an investigation of compromise, and I think that you can't be worried about being likable if you're challenging the notions of what food and work and society are holding up as valuable. And Lucian is somebody who really sticks to his guns, and there are scenes and situations in the film that I think that a lot of people, you know, can't see from his point of view, and then there are definitely times when it turns a corner and you definitely do empathize with him.
Well, this, I mean, I think probably those who haven't worked in the food industry at all really don't know what goes into it and don't know how big a difference there is between one kitchen and the next. And so the ingredients above all, which is a lot of the focus of this movie, you have people like Lucian Echevarria going to the back doors of restaurants with these absolutely gorgeous mushrooms that he's picked. And either they want them or they don't. And the ones that don't are getting these sort of plastic packaged things whose quality in every way is going to be so much lower. And it's just, like, watching it, I think, is just an education about things like that.
Yeah, we definitely were focused on making a back-of-the-house food movie. You know, so many, and there's some great food movies that have come before us. We're big fans of Babette's Feast, for example. But a lot of the movies that have come before are more about eating than they are about cooking. And we really wanted to focus on the back of the house, everything that happens before the food hits the plate. And I think that there's definitely a different kind of intimacy that you can get access to by focusing on those particular spaces, not only just in the kitchens themselves, but out in the actual woods and the actual seasons where certain types of mushrooms are found.
Now, both the character of Lucian and his wife Regina are of Basque origin. Do you have a particular connection to Basque cooking or Basque country?
You know, I grew up on the West Coast between Northern California and Oregon, and you know, there are a lot of Basque immigrants in that part of the country. Before I started writing the script, I was fortunate enough to get some time in a great Basque chef's kitchen, Gerald Tiragoyen in San Francisco, in his restaurant Piperad, and his other restaurant Bocadillos. And you know, I just was able to kind of watch how his operation runs and ask him lots of questions about his cooking. And I just think that from a culinary standpoint, you know, they're a culture that really has a close connection with foraging, with hunting mushrooms and wild foods, and also fishing, which are both part of our story. And this is really, you know, it's more a story about Basque Americans, about second generation, a second generation culture, and kind of dealing with that tension between the lessons that your grandparents taught you and kind of what's being assimilated by being an American. So I think that there are people of my generation who are really kind of going back to those lessons of our grandparents and going back to more traditional ideas of you know, where our families came from in Europe or elsewhere in the world, and finding some comfort in that.
What is your own background in cooking and in mushroom foraging?
Well, my interest in mushrooms, you could say it started before I was born. My grandfather was poisoned by a mushroom a couple of years before I was even on the earth, and he survived that poisoning. So even though we were a big fishing, hunting, and foraging family, mushrooms were sort of forbidden in the home for a number of years until I was a good rebellious teenager and started wanting to study and bring them home. And I had some great teachers along the way who had studied with San Francisco Mycological Society and some of the different mycological societies in the Northwest. And then when I moved to New York in 2006, I joined the New York Mycological Society, and now I'm very actively involved with that club, and I edit their newsletter.
So this film takes place on the East Coast, New York City, New England, that area, and you presumably did all the cinematography there locally. Is that correct? Did you have to learn a whole new kind of world of East Coast mushrooms and seasons and that kind of thing?
Definitely. You know, we spent about, I would say, 3 years just kind of rewriting the story for the East Coast and for those species, and really getting grounded with the local differences and there are quite a few dramatic differences between how things grow on the East Coast and what grows there and the West Coast. As I mentioned, the New York Mycological Society was really, it became a second family for us. They took us in and really helped us adapt our knowledge to that specific environment. And I really consider them some of my closest friends now.
This is a low-budget independent film. It's very well done. It's very well edited. How did you pull it off? I take it this is your first film?
This is our first feature. Julia and I have been working together for 16 years on short films, and we also programmed a film festival in Austin, Texas for a number of years. It was definitely a challenge to make a film on as little money as we had, and so we had to be very smart and creative about how we were going to get our production value in other ways without spending money. Shooting over the course of about 18 months to get actual mushroom species and actual seasons for all of our exteriors, that was a big investment of time, and we knew that that would be something that would show on the screen without having to spend any actual money on that. We just needed to be committed to being out there in the woods quite a lot, even without our crew, to get additional B-roll footage, so that we had lots and lots and lots of mushrooms to choose from.
Well, and that is a beautiful part of the movie, is just that the cinematography, the photography of these beautiful, I want to say creatures, like these beautiful pieces of life on this planet, as well as the shots of cooking, of being in kitchens and making albondigas and all kinds of delicious things that made your mouth water. Speaking of which, what's on the menu tonight?
That's a surprise for me. I've been a fan of the Coyote Cafe for a number of years. I own their cookbook, and I have no idea what they're going to cook. I kind of want to keep it a surprise.
Ah, okay. Well, we look forward to seeing you there. Jason Cortland is co-director, writer, and lead actor in the film Now Forager, which screens today at 5 o'clock at the New Mexico History Museum. And once again, it's part of the Festival Eve event of the Santa Fe Film Festival. It's followed by a three-course tasting menu at the Coyote Cafe. And you will be there answering questions, is that right?
Absolutely. Ask any question you like. I'm happy to answer.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and we'll see you then.
Thanks so much. I appreciate you having us on.